coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Patricia Spears Jones. Patricia Spears Jones is a cultural activist, educator, and the Poet Laureate of New York State. Her most recent poetry collection is The Beloved Community, published by Copper Canyon Press. How are you doing today, Patricia Spears Jones?
I'm awake.
I'm glad you're awake. All right.
And well, it's raining.
Well, it's good to connect you. You know, we've known each other for a long, long time. Patricia, you were appointed the Poet Laureate of New York State last year. Mm-hmm. How has that honor and position changed your writing life?
Not much. It's an honor, and I'm very busy. I was already very busy because The Beloved Community came out just about the same time, and I was sort of like, oh, well, this is just another additional thing. But, you know, the Poet Laureate of New York State, basically we have to show up at a ceremony and be lauded, which is very nice. And then we have to do 3 programs. And that's it, basically.
Oh, okay. So
anything else that's on top of that is really on the Poet Laureate.
Okay, the reason why I ask that is because, you know, you're a Poet Laureate of a state, you're not a city. And I think of states like New York or California, whether the Poet Laureate would be given money to travel throughout the state.
Well, they gave us a check, you know, so I can use that for travel and stuff. But mostly, we live in the era of Zoom. So when mm-hmm. people contact me, it's usually over the internet and okay. stuff. And most of the time, when they ask me, can you come to our library? And I go, no, I can't because I don't have the time. Right. But if it's something really special, like this week, I'm going to be going to Bedford Hills to the women's prison there because there's a conference that was organized by Loyola Marymount and the prison because there are a number of women there who are getting their degrees. Mm-hmm. Yay for them. And so I get to go and read my poems and talk a little bit with them be part of a workshop and stuff. So it'll be interesting. And that's because I'm the state poet.
Mm. Well, you know, Elizabeth Alexander and the Mellon Foundation has given the Academy of American Poets money for poet laureates across the country.
Yeah, I know. I applied for it.
Okay, good. And I was wondering in terms of, did you develop a program that you wanted to initiate in New York?
Well, I'll see if it happens. Okay. I made an application. That doesn't mean I'll get it.
Okay, but what was the program that you wanted to
do? I don't want to talk about it.
Okay, you don't want to talk about it. Okay, because this is radio.
Right. No, because it hasn't happened.
That's been funny, right.
Okay. So I can't talk about something that hasn't
happened.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a question where you can talk about something that's happened. what advice, on a serious note, Patricia, what advice would you give to other poet laureates across the country? You know, I asked the question, how has it had an effect on your writing life? Perhaps, you know, it hadn't. But what advice would you tell people who are poet laureates?
Actually, I sought their advice. And when I was at AWP, I got to talk to Tracy Brimhall and Curtis Chrysler. They're the poet laureates of Kansas and Indiana. Okay. And they're incredibly busy. I mean, you know, Curtis goes all over the state. Both of them, I think the basic thing they said to me was to work with local poets mm-hmm. and when you're doing any kind of project. And I think, you know, I don't sort of separate things out the way a lot of people do. I remember going somewhere with somebody was saying to asking Lorenzo Thomas, how was he dealing with his writing life? And he kind of looked at them. He had that, you know, how Lorenzo used to have that kind of look mm-hmm. on his eye, like, what the hell are you asking me? And I know what he meant, because it was like he sort of came up with some kind of BS for them. But I don't understand why people think that there is a writing life and some other life. I don't get it. I never have, and I probably never will.
Well, the reason why some people say that is because some people say, okay, the focus of their life is on the writing. They don't really want to do a lot of readings. They don't want to do workshops. And so, you know, their thing is the writing comes first, you know. And so there's that sort of
distinction. They don't want to make, well, then they obviously can afford to do that. Most of us can't.
Right, exactly.
Most of us don't have that kind of money.
Well, talking about money, you were the 11th winner of the Jackson Poetry Prize. And that prize comes with a nice amount of money. What did the prize enable you to do? And did it come at the right time back in 2017?
That changed my life. It literally changed my life on all kinds of levels, because I have been literally working ever since I was like 16 years old. And because of the Jackson Prize, I could do things like take and use the residency that I got from the Robert Rauschenberg Foundation in Captiva, Florida. I could go to France for a residency that the Bao Institute had at the Camargo Foundation. I could not have to work all the time. And consequently, I wrote a significant number of poems, got to see two of the most beautiful places on this planet, and paid off a whole lot of debts. So, you know, and literally that money came just as I was literally doing the head scratching, like, how am I going to be able to pay my rent in the next two or three weeks? I mean, next two or three months. It was, I was on that margin, to put it mildly. So, because I've never, you know, I've never made money. So this was, you know, but that was one part of it. The other part of it was just the sheer recognition. I had no idea that my work was being seen by such amazing people who decided that I deserved it. That was unbelievable to me. And, you know, after feeling like, you know, who knows who Patricia Spears Jones is, I realized a whole lot of people do.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of us do. And I always associate you with New York City, but you were born in Forest City, Arkansas. When I think of that, I think of, you know, writers like Haki Madhubuti and Henry Dumas, who also published, who were born in Arkansas. You recently received, next month, I think you're going to receive the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Porter Fund, which supports the literary arts in Arkansas. Talk briefly about growing up in Arkansas. You talk about working since 16. Talk about your parents and your early interest in writing.
Well, I'm one of those people that was writing, you know, like most poets start like when you're 11 or 12 years old. And I love to read. I mean, and although I grew up in a house that didn't have a lot of books, my mom would always bring home like all the glossy magazines, Life and Look, and Women's Ladies' Home Journal, and, you know, all those McCall's, etc.
Mademoiselle, or something like that.
Yeah, 17. that was later. and the 17, and we also, of course, like every other Black family in America, we subscribed to Ebony.
And Jet.
And Jet. Well, we bought Jet. We subscribed to Ebony.
Okay.
But I also would go to the local drugstore and read the junior classics. And I discovered Hit Parader, which was a magazine that like literally printed the lyrics of songs. And that's where I learned about who John Coltrane was. Like when he died in 1967, somebody wrote a whole thing about him, and I had never heard of him. I was like 15, 16 years old. And so I had to find out who John Coltrane was. And, you know, so I, you know, and I probably lived in the library. So that's kind of how all this stuff, got started. I was very quiet and I was a nerd, I was like the smart girl that everybody was a little scared of. I was glad that I got into a really great local college in Memphis. It was called Southwestern in Memphis when I went, but now it's Rhodes College. And I was one of the 11 Black students in that year. And all of us, except I think one person, graduated, right, in 1973. And so we, and I was the only one from outside of Memphis. And so I was the first Black girl in the dorms, and all kinds of other stuff. It was wild. I mean, I didn't realize I was the first of anything, but I was also the first person in my whole family, immediate and extended, who went to college. And my brother was the next person, because my mother worked her butt off to make sure that we could go to school.
Right. Well, you also went on to receive your MFA from Virginia College of Fine Arts. What attracted you to that program, and who were some of your mentors there?
Well, when I was working at for the Mass Council, I was I got laid off like everybody else. It was just a miserable time, and I had a manuscript that the people at Kalaloo had sat on for a year, then rejected. And I stopped writing. And Pamela Painter, who I had met when I was working long, long, long time before at the Coordinating Council of Literary Magazines, remember CCLM, said, why don't you apply here? If you do that, I'll help you get in, And I said, well, okay. And so I sent some, scraggly poems to the Vermont College people, and lo and behold, they accepted me. Next thing I know, I was going to Vermont in the middle of winter, and I had really great advisors. And my first advisor was the wonderful poet Linda Hull, who is still very, very, very much missed. And I also worked with Mark Doty, briefly with Belle Waring. May she rest in peace. May her and Linda rest in peace. And my final advisee was David Rivard. But it was interesting when I got there. Me, Tim Siebels, and Earl Braggs. For the people of color. Now, I don't think there were even any Asians. That was how white it was. But I liked the program because it was a low residency. And so basically you were in correspondence with your advisor. I have all these incredible letters from Linda and from Mark and from David that I will treasure forever. My thesis was basically the basis for The Weather That Kills.
Mm, that's interesting. Let's turn, Patricia Spears Jones, let's turn to your new book. When one thinks of the beloved community, one often thinks of Martin Luther King Jr. as well as the Congressman John Lewis. King's last book was entitled Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community? Talk about selecting the beloved community for your new collection, and share with us, our listeners, the title poem.
Oh, okay. Well, I sort of came to the beloved community not so much through either King or the other congressman, but actually from just Christian, just long-term Christian commentary. It's a great phrase, like, may the perpetual life shine. It's a great phrase. And I wanted it to sort of talk about how we are in a beloved community, how we create a beloved community, and how fragile it is. Mm-hmm. And especially because most of the time we encounter people we don't know. And So there are these kinds of moments of accident. I call it accidental intimacies, where you're on the subway and all of a sudden you see somebody who's crying. Oh my God! And you go like, and you either offer some kind of support or you just go away. Or you're in a restaurant and you all of a sudden everybody's singing happy birthday to some poor person, and you join in because, it's their birthday. So here's the beloved community. And it's a very Brooklyn-based poem. The beloved community. The Bangladeshi man walks slowly, so slowly. I know he is ill. He shuffles a broom about the laundromat, then sits in front of the largest dryer. Then a Latina comes and frantic, pointing at the flyer posted on the laundromat's window. What happened? She asks. The attendant says she died. But when? How? 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks, he says. He knows only this. Dead. 2 weeks. The memorial is for later in the day in a place far from Halsey. The flyer's crisp image of a black woman's face, smiling, young looking, but she was not young. 2 weeks. La Senora shakes her head, her purple streaked hair tamed by her sadness. She always said hello. She was always smiling. She says this to me. I nod and try to smile with her memory. She looks once again at the image, black and white, utilitarian, on the glass surface, then walks out onto the sidewalk, undone by new grief.
Patricia Spears Jones reading the title poem from the collection, The Beloved Community. I like how you said this poem takes place in Brooklyn, but we know that the Halsey neighborhood is there. But I look at the fact that this is a laundromat, and you go back to your definition of beloved community, a place where people, it's not a beauty parlor, it's a place where people come together and they're washing their clothes and things of that sort. Mm-hmm. This could be some place in India where, where you're by the river. And I like this sense of that. And then there's a sense of you're talking about Christian community. A sense of baptism, water and stuff. It's all coming in here. People are cleaning their clothes. But you bring together everybody, someone's from Bangladesh, someone's Latino, And I thought that this poem really added to the thing about the beloved community. Because what people always say, if you don't see the beloved community, you have to try to work to bring it into existence. And I think that what you've done in this poem is brought the beloved community into existence. It doesn't have to be Brooklyn. It could be anywhere.
Thank you.
Let's hear another poem. I want you to read Fire and Last Nights in Virginia.
First and Last Night in Virginia.
That's because we're here in DC.
Well, this I 2020 I was the Hollins. I had the residency at Hollins University, and I literally got on the train on January 31st. To go to Roanoke, and
so this is like a Frank O'Hara poem, right?
it's like one of the few COVID poems I wrote. Okay. But literally, it was the first, and this is what happened: the first and last night, first and last nights in Virginia, January and May, 2020. First night in Virginia, we stop at a CVS late. The store is vast and sorry. The lone clerk slow wipes a counter. She slumps, sags, all that worry. In her spills onto the counter's hard plastic top. I gather items and wait for her suddenly cheerful acknowledgement. It seems as if fate has made this place a symbol of American want. Everything is in this place, seems cheap except the products for sale, the lighting, the railing, that counter. This is replicated in Walmart, Walgreens. Only the dollar store does not pretend to be anything other than a repository of things you need and things you don't. The clerks were not well paid, and at night left to fend for themselves in this plastic vastness. On my last visit, the clerk stands behind a cheap plastic protector, more symbolic than reality. She wears her mask and behind it smiles. She has a job, and that's good, but this is yet another display, and she's expendable. We all are.
Thank you, Patricia Spears Jones. You know, when you end that poem, I had a question in my head. Are poets expendable?
Of course they are. Everybody's expendable.
Okay.
Depending on the situation you're in. Mm-hmm. In 2020, we had a president who basically said, all y'all are expendable. Mm-hmm. And the response in the business community was to put people in harm's way. That poor woman in that store had no protection. She had none. I mean, it's just extraordinary to me that people forget that. You know, my grandfather was a Church of God in Christ preacher, and I can start preaching.
Dude, you can start preaching. This is morning. It doesn't have to be a Sunday morning. It can be a Thursday morning. So, if you want to preach, you know, we got another half hour for a show. So if you just want to go off and preach Patricia Spears Jones, you have ear time. And you can convert some people, and maybe down the road they'll become sponsors for WPFW because they've heard the word from you.
Okay. Well, please support this station.
All right. Well, let me ask you this question. I appreciate that. I'm looking at what you said, how this poem came about, and I'm looking at how does, and this is like a prose poem, how does, are there times when the content dictates the form in terms of the shape of the poem?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, this could not have been like a haiku or something. It would be ridiculous. And also because I really enjoyed some of the end rhymes in this. And I liked also the, you know, just using things like, you know, there's a lot of ah sounds and a sounds throughout this poem. It's almost like a sigh, if not a relief, but a sigh, you know, so.
Right, yeah. Right. You know, you have a poem in here, and I always laugh when I always see his name. Somebody said, Ethelbert, you know, the person used to always be up in your office. I said, oh, really? So you have a poem here for Jerry Allen. I was wondering if you could read this poem, because here in Washington, you know, Jerry was a Howard University graduate, pianist. And so you have a poem here, and I thought it'd be nice for you, since we're a jazz station.
You know, I mean, every once in a while, you know, I'm sure you've had this happen to you. A poem is sent. Right. It's just sent. And when I had literally the year before I had seen Jerry Allen perform in Harlem in Sugar Hill, that wonderful pocket park in Sugar Hill that Karen Taylor and all these other people from well, we're still here organized. And then I thought, oh, my goodness. And it was a beautiful night. I looked up and it was the night sky, and I thought, well, that's where she is. Mm-hmm. For Jerry Allen. She's sitting in the half moon's cup. Earthly roads had led to this new geography. Planets and stars, dust returns. Her hands besotted with this cosmic baby brand, playing starlight in a vast blackness, shifting with her tender tempos, pacing the eternal. Oh, darkling descant. Blackbirds and fireflies trace her unhearable musings in this evening's skies.
Thank you, Patricia. And thank you for that poem for Jerry Allen. You also have a poem, and this poem was in the Best American Poetry collection that came out in 2023. You have a poem for Greg Tate that's entitled "The Devil's Wife Explains Broken 45s." And there's
well, it's dedicated. It's dedicated to. I've been doing a series of poems about the devil's wife. She's not a happy person.
And I tell people I have a poem. I didn't know the devil was married.
And you know, it's like she's just not a happy person. Okay. And I grew up, as I grew up in Arkansas, and we always, when the sun was shining and it was raining, somebody would say the devil is beating his
Beating his
wife
wife, right.
because she didn't cook him no rice. That was the chant, which is, when you think about it, it's pretty horrifying. Like, really horrifying. So this is like about the fifth or sixth.
You know, I want to tell you something. The last time I remember the sun shining and the rain coming down was when Richard Nixon resigned from the presidency here in
Oh, wow.
Washington. So that's
Oh,
with the
Lord.
sun shining and it was raining at the same time. I thought that was an omen. So maybe getting back to Arkansas, your folks knew what was right.
Okay. Well, I mean, also, other people throughout the South and the Caribbean have also said this too. So it's like really good. So anyway, my response was, the devil is married, but then I thought, but then I thought, this is the series of poems are basically a critique of the patriarchy, obviously. And so, so anyway, this is called The Devil's Wife Explains Broken 45s. And the reason why it's dedicated to Greg Tate is because, James Brown is in this poem, but there's a James Brown poem in my other book, the A Lucent Fire, that Greg said to me. He said that was one of his favorite James Brown poems. And I thought, well, okay. So I thought, and I think, if Greg is anywhere near the devil, he's probably cussing him out. I hope so. Anyway, The Devil's Wife Explains Broken 45s. There was a time, James Brown sang, and I want to dance, but that causes the devil to prance upon me, then lash higher his liege around my waist and squeeze me till my voice box almost shatters. You're a doll, he says, as he smashes our turntable, laughing at the clatter ancient 45 RPMs make as they break. Treasures from a lost last century, when sweet soul music elevated our scissoring feet. How he hated haloed afros, radiant with pride, and that slide away from suffering. The devil hates black genius, made him work harder than hard to render it witless and dope stone. He hates having to move one iota out of his trifling comfort zone. Can I listen to one piece of my heart untarnished by his guile? Child, soul music is now in limbo, and me bruised again, cleaning up those broken 45s. But somewhere on the other side of this sad kingdom, another woman augurs the audio, and James Brown sings out, There Was a Time.
Thank you, Patricia Spears Jones. When I'm listening to you, I can hear the blues coming in there. And then what I also like is you had this line here about the devil, hates black genius. And I remember when Greg passed away, people were talking about him like the Langston, like this genius child, and that loss. So I like how all that comes together in this poem. We're going to take a little break, Patricia Spears Jones, because you said you wanted to preach and we're going to have a little pass the little cup. But what
Pass
happened?
the cup, pass the cup.
Right. But we're
Send
going
the money, send the
to
money.
take right. So we take a little break. My guest this morning, I'm enjoying this conversation, is Patricia Spears Jones. She's a poet laureate of New York State. She's been reading work from The Beloved Community, which is her recent book of poetry published by Copper Canyon Press. The station is the station. WPSW 89.3 FM. The show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller.
Adasi, the African Diaspora Ancestral Commemoration Institute, will host a free DC Emancipation Day program entitled Black Liberation Struggles in Global Africa. Then and now, on Tuesday, April 16th, 2024, from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Enlightened Inc., 1205 Marion Barry Avenue Southeast, the program will commemorate the enslaved ancestors who crossed over the Old Navy Yard Bridge, the precursor to the 11th Street Bridge in Southeast. From enslavement in Maryland to freedom in the District of Columbia after the abolition of slavery in D.C. on April 16, 1862. It will feature esteemed historian C.R. Gibbs and many others. For information, please call 202-505-2896 or visit AdaciAncestors.org. That's ADACI Ancestors.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Patricia Spears Jones. Patricia, Courtney Thorson, an associate professor of English at the University of Oregon, recently published The Sisterhood, How a Network of Black Women Writers Changed American Culture. Your name appears in this book. You went to a sisterhood meeting in 1977. Talk about the sisterhood and talk about your relationship with June Jordan, a co-founder of the organization.
Well, yeah, I mean, I went to several meetings, not just one.
Well, that was the first one in 77.
And went to, you know, and it's really the book is, I mean, I had the great pleasure of having a conversation with Margot Jefferson and Courtney at Columbia earlier this year about the book. It's very interesting. When I got the initial request from Courtney, I wasn't quite sure what she was asking about. And I had forgotten that somebody was taking minutes of those meetings. And I was a very young person, and I got to be involved along with a lot of other younger women, poets and writers. And part of it was because of June. And I met June in the early, like, 1975 or so. Yeah, probably around that time. When Sarah Miles, Cynthia Craman, and me were organizing readings at Sabasics, which no longer exists. And so we were bold enough to ask June to read in our reading. And she was bold enough to say yes. and she was a delight and a little scarifying too, because, you know, it was June. She's utterly beautiful, incredibly charismatic, wonderful poet, and very generous to us young ladies. And we were very happy she was. Then she also started, along with Alice and others, to organize a protest of the American Poetry Review because, as Alice pointed out, she had a column in the magazine, but they didn't publish her poems. Mm-hmm. And almost all of the poets they published were white, an occasional Asian person, and that was about it. And so she, all of a sudden I got wrangled into, I mean, it was the first time I got wrangled into like literary politics. Oh my goodness. It was, you know, but I got to meet all these people. Got to go to June's fabulous apartment on 8th Avenue in Brooklyn. And, you know, I think Marilyn Hacker was there and all these other people. So, and downtown, you know, the early 70s in New York was just an incredible time for a range of poetry communities. I mean, I went to the workshops at the Poetry Project. Lewis Warsh was my first major teacher. He was incredible, and I met all these, you know, Ted Berrigan and all those guys. And then the New Yorker Poets Cafe was there, so I met all the Latino people. And then there was this whole women's community. Junior Books was there, Women's Books. That's why I met Adrienne and Audrey and all these people. So, and then I realized now that it was also a small community. It was like maybe a couple hundred people we're talking about. And so at some point, we all kind of ran into each other in some ways. So when Faye Chang was doing the basement workshop, we could, you know, we would go and meet all the Chinese and Japanese and, you know, whatever, whoever the Asian American poets were. So, and then there was Steve Cannon and Reed Cannon and Johnson. And then it was Reed and Cannon because then they got mad at Joe Johnson. Anyway, so, you know, all this kind of stuff was going on. So it was amazing. So I've been writing, working on my memoirs, and I'm just, and I live downtown. I didn't live in Harlem. I didn't live in Brooklyn. I was in East Village. So I was like in one of the areas that like is like the, you know, locale for bohemianism. So I just felt like New York City, everything was open to me. And poetry was just, you know, it was just dynamic. And if you wanted to be part of it, you could be. If you wanted to run away, that's okay too.
Hmm. I'm glad you mentioned Marilyn Hacker, since she's my guest next week.
Tell her I said hi.
I will do that. You know, and then I was wondering, did you ever encounter I know you encountered Zoe Englesley because you mentioned Steve Cannon, and I was just wondering
about encounters Zoe.
Right. Well, that's another person who's deceased that people you know I felt was very important when we talk about poets of Central America, and I say that as a segue into your poem on the death of Clara Bellegra, 1924 to 2018. If you could read that poem for us.
Well, let me give you just a little bit of background. I remember earlier I mentioned being at the Rauschenberg residency in Captiva, Florida. And so one of the things that I was able to do there was to see the stars, right? And actually to identify Orion's belt. So Orion comes up in this. But I remember Senora Alegria because of her relationship with Carolyn Fauché, and also because of the protest against in support of the Sandinistas, against the Somoza government, also that her work in El Salvador as well. So we were doing all these resistance stuff in the 80s. And when I tell people, like, you know, yes, I met all these like, you know, Nicaraguans in the late 1970s, blah, blah, blah. They're like, really? And I'm like, everything was open. Mm-hmm. You ran it, you met all kinds of people. But I just thought she was an amazing, she's just amazing. Anyway, on the death of Clarabel Aldia, 1924-2018. On Earth, she marked her days with rage and love, and fought the generals and their army of thieves and torturers. Her pen was mighty, so also their arms. Death is the shadow twin, the one remaining in the foothills by the back door in a convent off a mountainside. And yet, a mother's breast awaits her infant's mouth. A rooster crows and children gather what food there is, while bells ring across the foothills when the soldiers leave. A music of hope, even as another child is buried and a landmine erupts a few kilometers from hospital. We live in a time of suffering in places of beauty, where the water and air meet in mountains dark soiled. Food grows effortlessly here, effortlessly, and so does greed. We live in a time of suffering, in places of beauty, where yesterday's rebel is today's resident, and greed cowers the hurt children who hunger not only for their mother's milk, but a safe place where peace storms the land with smiles and the tender removal of all aspects of a phantasm of peace, a peace unlike the other ones, negotiated and then neglected, thus military rifles, handguns, and machetes, Bowie knives, unexploded landmines, all made so that peace will end and terror return. What you hear is the sea. The heavy waves come in, go out. Stars pattern Orion's belt, or is that his heel? And then another woman of letters departs. Will she step on Orion's heel? Would she say, excuse me, I did not see your heel? Would she try to hide her error as her celestial garments drag across the night sky? What if Orion could speak? And if he did, would he say, all the poets love my heel or my belt? You're not the first to seek an anchor here.
Thank you, Patricia Spears Jones, reading a poem about Clarabelle Allegra. Clarabelle's books are were published by Curbstone Press, a press founded in 1975 by Judith Dolan Taylor or Sandy Taylor. Those books were acquired by Northwest University Press. The work is still available. What I come back to in this poem, Patricia, you sort of play off it twice, is the line, we live in a time of suffering and places of beauty, which is just a gorgeous line. You know, it's like, it's one of those, you know, you're reading a poem and you all of a sudden you come across a line that's just like a standalone, you know, or you hold it in your mouth. And then I like how you repeat it's a little, like a little blues thing. I'll repeat a little bit again with a little change. And I just felt that this was just really a wonderful poem. I want to thank you for sharing that with our listeners. I want to ask you about a poet, a name that appears in your acknowledgement. You thank a lot of people at the end of your book. One is Alice Notley. Talk about Alice's work and your relationship with her.
Well, I mean, Alice isn't probably one of the greatest poets in the last 20 or 60 years. I mean, sorry, I missed her big reading last night at the New York Poets Prize. She was married to Ted Berrigan, and then widowed, and then she married somebody else and get widowed again. This woman, she's twice widowed, my goodness. But she's like about 1,000 books out. I just think she's just one of those, she is one of those people whose life is all about writing. As she pointed out, I've never had a job. I just write. You know, but she's also been a mother and wife. So, and she just, you know, she comes from the desert, which is very interesting. She grew up in California in that, where that little town, it's like, where it was the hottest town, like literally the temperature is the hottest in America. And then has lived in like New York and Paris. So she lives in these places of extremes, I think.
We'll talk about extremes. Were there any ways in which your association with her and her work pulled your work in sort of in a more experimental area, a direction?
Not just her. I mean, she's like one of many people like that. But I've always done that. I mean, I am fascinated by people who take risk in their work, whatever that may be. And I also love the fact that there's some real sense of discipline about looking at language and like what you can do with it. I mean, I like her work. I like Brenda Hillman's work. I like, obviously, other people, Maureen Owen, and the person who pulled my coat the most was Lorenzo Thomas, and so who I think is one of the great experimenters, and may he rest in peace, or maybe not, probably running around, hanging out with Steve Cannon. they're at the Poets Bar. And I mean, my beloved community is probably the poetry community in the best sense of the word, of being able to read and acknowledge and correspond with all these amazing people who are writing right now. I just feel like we're in, oh my gosh, I think this may be the most amazing flourishing for American poets and for poets of this hemisphere. You know, although one of my absolute favorite poets is of Mongolian descent, you know, the Sui Nguyen, who lives in Taiwan. So I just think it's I think all of these people, I mean, read Alice, read Peter Cubino, read Ann Wallman, read, you know, Lorenzo Thomas. I had the great joy of doing a podcast with Charlie Green where I would just talk about a poem, and I got to read The Bathers, which I think is one of the greatest poems ever about the civil rights movement. And it's, but you're talking about purgation. It's all about baptism. Mm-hmm. It's all about purgation. It's all about the removal, not only of personal sins, but the sin, literally the public sins of this republic.
Well, let's move from, you know, you talk about all this poetry being out there, and you're part of all that poetry being out there, but you also write plays and talk about, you know, Song for New York, What Women Do While Men Sit Knitting, Your Mother. You have a, you know, and I really, maybe because I'm not in New York, you know, I always saw you as a poet. I didn't know you wrote plays until I was preparing for this program. And I said, oh, Patricia Spears Jones has plays. Okay. But talk about, you know, and I think about poets who sometimes moved into theater and playwriting because they wanted to expand their audience. And so they got in to say, I want to put something on a stage as opposed to just have somebody, you know, reading, hearing my poems in the cafe. Talk about this movement from poetry to play.
Well, I was commissioned.
Oh, okay.
You know, basically, one of the first things, you have to remember when I came to New York, I worked with Mabel Mines. Mabel Mines is an international theater, experimental theater company. And I met Lee Brewer and Ruth Malachek and, they're all gone now. David Warlow, the great David Warlow, and Fred Newman. When I was in college, I was their host, as it was, during the annual symposium. And then my ex-boyfriend came up to New York to work with them, and all these other guys did. And then when I came to New York, I, you know, hung out with them. And my first gig was to work the curtains for the B.B. for animation at the Museum of Art during the Marcel Duchamp.
Do you have that in your resume? I worked a curtain. I'm a curtain worker.
Yeah, right. Like, you know, there were these like curtains that you had to do while they were performing. Anyway, it was hilarious. And so that's my entry. So I, you know, love theater, and it, which is really interesting because I hardly ever saw anything until I was like literally 18, 17 or 18 years old. And so years later, because Ruth Malachek really loved my poetry, she was working on a Brecht play, and then she hated the Brecht play. She just couldn't stand it. And so she said, I need something else. And so she asked me to write Mother. Mm-hmm. And it's a play with music. So Carter Burwell wrote the music, and I wrote the lyrics for this and all this stuff. It took about 2 years, and it's a very short play. I'm still trying to get it published, but it's also based on the Gorky novel about the mother who becomes a revolutionary because her son. And it was, we had a ball doing that, you know. Because the thing that's great about theater is it's collaborative. And you don't realize that until things like when we had the audition for the leader, and I always wanted, you know, that particular character to be a Black man. All these guys show up and they read, they do a co-reading. And then you realize just how hard it is to be an actor in this world. All kinds of stuff like that. But I really enjoyed hearing different people saying words that I wrote. And it was like, it was fascinating. So that's, you know, but all these things were commissioned. You know, you can, you know, including like Lave or Love, depending on how you say it, the long poem, that's the prim for the beloved community. And that was commissioned for the Museum of Modern Art's Jacob Lawrence exhibition by Elizabeth Alexander. Yay, Elizabeth. Mm. So, and it's the original poem was even longer than the one that wound up in the catalog, they asked me to like to cut like 10 lines because it was so long. But a lot, you know, I'm fascinated. I mean, I grew up in a Pentecostal church. So, but it's like weird because I also went to like, you know, Episcopal mission school. So I have both those ritual ideas in my sort of psychological DNA. And so that, so seeing full, you know, real total immersion baptism is always fascinated me.
Well, I'm going to ask you one last question for Patricia Spears Jones. Going back to your earlier life, you worked as a grant program director for the Coordinating Council Literary Magazines from 1977 to 1981. How helpful was that job into your career, and what did you learn that you didn't know?
I got to read a lot of really interesting poets whose work I had never heard of. I got to see the range of journals and how people approach print, which is great. That era was an incredible era of experimentation, physical experimentation. You know, there are magazines and boxes and blah, blah. But I also got to do something really wonderful, which was to create programs in support of women's literature, quote unquote, minority literature. So, you know, we got to give money to Revista Chicana Requeña and others like Latino magazines and Black magazines. I think maybe, what's that? Oh, gay magazines and women's journals too. And so I got to sort of see that. I was writing, but it was more about what I was just learning reading. I mean, I think the most important thing for all poets, I don't know where you're from and what language you're working in, is your ability to read and absorb both the work of your contemporaries, but those who've come before.
I'm going to ask you to do one thing as before we sign off, and that is just give us maybe three or four names of writers that, because you've mentioned a lot of names in this program, three or four names of poets right now that you feel, okay, this is who I am enjoying right now, and this is who I would recommend you read, just off the top of your head.
Oh my God, that's hard to do. I'm sorry. besides Alice, who would I think? I mean, I guess I really want people to read Lorenzo.
Okay, good.
Want people to, I mean, I think his phrase thinking in words is just so important to me.
Right. And I think Alden Nielsen edited his collected work.
That's incredible. And I would say my girlfriend, my Brooklyn girlfriend, Cheryl Boyce Taylor, who is mother of Fife Dog, but she's like an amazing poet, just an amazing poet. And then there's a young poet, young African-American poet, who was one of my former students, named Jordan Franklin. She has, her first book came out last year, I think, yes. And then another poet who I think is extremely important is Marilyn Chin.
You see, this Marilyn Chin was on the program recently.
Yeah.
You know, I knew if I asked you this question, you would have all these names. So I want to thank you, Patricia Spears Jones, because you're always a source of information and inspiration. My guest today has been Patricia Spears Jones. She's a cultural activist, educator, and poet laureate of New York State. You've been listening to her read from her last collection, The Beloved Community, published by Copper Canyon Press. Congratulations for your award. Are you going back to Arkansas, or is that going to be a Zoom thing?
No, I have my dress and everything. I'm good.
All right. Okay. All right. Travel safely. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Right. The show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Code Pink, Women for Peace, is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
ADASI, the African Diaspora Ancestral Commemoration Institute, will host a free D.C. Emancipation Day program entitled Black Liberation Struggles in Global Africa. Then and now, on Tuesday, April 16th, 2024, from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Enlightened Inc., 1205 Marion Barry Avenue Southeast. The program will commemorate the enslaved ancestors who crossed over the Old Navy Yard Bridge, the precursor to the 11th Street Bridge in Southeast. From enslavement in Maryland to freedom in the District of Columbia after the abolition of slavery in D.C. on April 16, 1862. It will feature esteemed historian C.R. Gibbs and many others. For information, please call 202-505-2896 or visit adasiancestors.org. That's A-D-A-C-I ancestors.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Dori Ladner was a courageous civil rights activist. Her legacy lives on every time we choose to confront injustice. Dori Ladner's funeral will be held this Saturday, April 13th, at Shiloh Baptist Church, 1500 9th Street, Northwest, D.C., at 11 a.m. All are welcome to come and bid farewell to this icon of the civil rights movement. WPFW extends condolences to the family of Dori Ladner.
The search process for WPFW's next general manager is underway. Successful management searches begin by having conversations with stakeholders to clarify and document expectations for future management. Therefore, WPFW's local station board is inviting all stakeholders to participate in our online survey. To complete the survey, please click the link on WPFW's website. Because we need your input, the deadline for the survey has been extended to Friday, April 12, 2024. Thank you.
Born of Haitian descent, Jerry Paris, WPFW's general manager, is moving on to retirement. On April 14th, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m., we will celebrate his departure at the VIP Room, 6201 3rd Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., with island flair, steel drums, a DJ, and food from the islands. That's April 14th from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m. For more information and tickets, call 202-368-4081 or visit Eventbrite and search for Jerry Paris Retirement. Seating is limited.
Sophie's Parlor is the original women's radio collective. Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m., the best music divas on radio at 89.3 FM and sophiesparlor.blogspot.com.
WPFW is looking for a new place to hang our hats and microphones. And we're betting that members of WPFW's In the Know listening community, folks like you, may know of spaces where we might make our new home. Have you walked past or know of a cool space that appears to be for lease? Hip us to it. Know of something that's not yet on the market? We're all ears. Your station for jazz and justice requires 2,200 square feet of space in Washington, D.C. or immediate environs. Metro accessible with nearby parking. We value your suggestions and observations as we embark on this vital mission.